Okay, so imagine for a second. You're a materials engineer.
Right.
You've spent, I don't know, years in the lab, mixing elements, running furnaces, testing samples. And then finally you do it. You create a material that sounds like it was ripped straight out of a comic book.
The big breakthrough moment.
Exactly. It's stronger than almost anything else in his class. It's incredibly tough, so it doesn't just shatter when you hit it. It is, a super material in every sense.
And if I remember this correctly, the best part is that it's cheap.
That's the thing. It doesn't need expensive, exotic stuff like titanium or tons of nickel. It's basically just iron and some pretty standard additives.
It sounds perfect. It's the holy grail of engineering. High performance, low cost.
But, like every superhero, it has a fatal flaw. It's almost too good. It turns out this material is so incredibly hard, you can't actually shape it.
Ah.
You want to make a ball bearing? Good luck. It'll just destroy your tools. Want to drill a hole in it? The drill bit will snap right off.
And that is the classic engineer's dilemma. You've got high performance on one side and processability, the ability to actually, make the thing on the other.
And they're at war.
They're almost always at war with each other.
It feels like a prank. You invent the perfect steel, but the punchline is it's just a useless brick because you can't cut it. Today, we are diving deep into a fascinating master's thesis from the University of Cambridge by Danny Lue. We are looking at a material called superbainite.
That's a very cool name.
It is, and specifically, we're looking at the mission to tame this metal, to figure out how to temporarily soften it so we can build with it and then harden it back up.
And the solution involves a really clever metallurgical trick with an even more dramatic name, the divorced eutectoid transformation.
Which sounds like a messy legal proceeding.
Or just a psychological thriller, maybe.
Right. But I promise it's actually a way to manipulate atoms. So let's unpack this. What exactly is superbainite and why is it causing such a headache?
Well, superbainite, or nanostructured bainite, if you want to be formal about it, is a huge leap forward in steel tech. And to get why it's so special, you have to look at it under a microscope, a very, very powerful one.
We're talking nanoscale here.
We are. Structurally, this steel is made of these extremely thin plates of something called bainitic ferrite. And these plates are just incredibly slender. We're talking 20 to 40 nanometers thick.
Okay, just to put that in perspective for everyone listening,
Yeah.
a single human hair is roughly, what, 80,000 nanometers wide?
Exactly. So these plates are thousands of times thinner than a hair. And in material science, fine almost always means strong.
Okay.
Because those plates are so thin and packed so tightly, the steel achieves incredible hardness up to 700 HV. That's Vickers hardness.
700 HV. Those are just numbers to me. What does that mean in the real world?
To give you some context, 700 HV is getting close to the hardness of the tool steels that are used to cut other metals. It's just immensely durable. It resists wear and tear better than almost anything. And the kicker is that it forms at pretty low temperatures, around 200 to 300 degrees Celsius.
Which is low for steel, right? Usually you're picturing blast furnaces.
Correct. It means you don't need extreme energy costs to create it, and you don't need expensive alloys, so it's cheap to make and it's incredibly strong.
So logically, we should be making everything out of this stuff. Why aren't we?
Because of that 700 HV number, that hardness is fantastic for the finished product. Like a bearing that has to spin for 20 years without wearing down. But to make that bearing,
Right, to cut it.
to cut the steel rod, drill the center, grind the surfaces, you need the steel to be much, much softer.
You can't carve a sculpture out of diamond with a plastic spoon.
That's a good way to put it. To machine steel comfortably, you usually want the hardness down around, say, 230 to 250 HV.
Okay, so we have a material that naturally sits at 700. We need it to be 230 just to work with it. That's a massive gap. It's not a little too hard, it's almost three times too hard.
It is. And the industry standard for this is a steel called SAE 52100. It's a high chromium bearing steel. We know how to soften that. It's a solved problem. But superbainite is just chemically stubborn.
And this is where the thesis comes in. Daniel Luo's work is all about this manufacturing paradox.
Yeah.
The standard way of softening steel is basically a waiting game.
It is. The process is called spheroidization annealing.
Yep.
It's a mouthful, but the concept is simple. You heat the steel up to a moderate temperature and you just let it sit.
For how long?
For standard bearing steel, it might take 10 to 16 hours.
Which is already a long time in a factory. That's a lot of energy.
It is. It's expensive and it creates a bottleneck.
Okay.
But for superbainite, because of its specific chemistry, it resists this process. And I mean, it really resists it. Previous research cited in this thesis showed it could take up to 42 days of tempering.
Wait, 42 days?
42 days.
That's not manufacturing. That's aging a fine whiskey. No factory on earth is going to let a part sit in an oven for a month and a half just to get it ready for a drill press. The inventory costs alone would kill you.
Precisely. It makes the material commercially useless. You can have the best steel in the world, but if it takes 42 days to prep for cutting, nobody will ever buy it. So the mission of this thesis was a rescue mission. They needed a shortcut.
And that brings us to the divorced eutectoid transformation.
Yes.
Before we get to the divorce,
yeah.
I want to make sure I get what the normal structure looks like. You mentioned spheroidization. What's actually happening inside the metal?
Okay, think of it this way. When steel cools down naturally, the carbon and iron like to arrange themselves in layers. Imagine a stack of plywood. You have a sheet of soft ferrite that's basically pure iron, then a sheet of hard cementite, which is iron carbide, then soft iron, then hard cementite.
Okay, a sandwich structure. Layer, layer, layer.
Right, we call that layered structure perlite. And physically, it's very rigid. If you try to cut through it, you have to saw through all those hard sheets of cementite. It acts like reinforcement.
Okay, so layers, hard. Makes sense.
Now, spheroidization, the softening process, is about breaking those layers up. You apply heat, and the system tries to lower its energy. Nature sort of hates sharp edges and flat sheets. It prefers spheres because they have the lowest surface area. So over time, and this is the slow part, those hard sheets break down and ball up.
So we're going from a stack of plywood to a ball pit.
That is a perfect analogy. You end up with these hard little BBs of cementite floating in this jelly of soft ferrite. When you try to machine that, the cutting tool can just push the little balls out of the way. The metal becomes ductile.
It flows. It's soft.
Exactly.
Okay, so layers are hard. Spheres are soft. We want spheres. But the normal way to get spheres takes 42 days for a super bainite. How does the divorce transformation speed that up?
The slow way is like building a house and then renovating it. You let the layers form, and then you spend weeks heating them up to dismantle them into spheres. The DET, the divorce solution, is about preventing the layers from ever forming in the first place.
Ah, so we're cheating the system.
We are tricking the steel. Here's how it works. When you start cooling the steel down from a high heat, if there are already tiny cementite particles, let's call them seeds, floating around.
Okay.
The carbon doesn't want to do the hard work of building a new layered structure. It's lazy.
It sees the seeds and thinks, eh, good enough.
Essentially, yes. The carbon atoms see those existing seeds and just latch onto them. Instead of building new layers, they just make the existing spheres slightly bigger.
So by having the seeds there, you skip the layer phase completely.
You skip the construction and the demolition, you go straight to the ball pit. And because the carbon only has to move a tiny distance to find a seed, it happens fast. We're talking minutes or hours, not days.
That sounds like a magic bullet. If DET is so efficient, why wasn't everyone just doing this with super bainite already?
Because super bainite wasn't designed to have seeds. It was designed for performance. And this leads to a bit of a chemical conflict. To process steel, you usually heat it up to, say, around 880 degrees Celsius to reset the structure. This is called austenitization.
Resetting, meaning you dissolve everything together.
In the solid state, yes. At 880 degrees, standard super bainite is designed to be fully austenitic. That means the iron and carbon mix perfectly.
So the seeds dissolve.
They dissolve completely. It's like stirring sugar into hot tea. Once it hits a certain temperature, the granules are gone. So if you heat standard super bainite to 880 degrees, you wipe the slate clean. No seeds left.
And if there are no seeds when you cool it down,
then the carbon has nowhere to go. It panics and it forms those hard perlite layers again. You're right back at square one.
So the thesis author, Daniel Luo, had a dilemma. The heat is needed to process the steel, but the heat kills the very seeds needed for the shortcut.
Exactly. And to fix this, the thesis proposed something that sounds, well, remarkably counterintuitive. To make the steel softer, they decided to add more carbon.
Wait, hang on. Carbon is the hardening agent in steel, right?
Yeah.
High carbon steel is harder than low carbon steel. That's rule number one.
It is.
So adding more carbon to soften, it sounds like, try and put out a fire with gasoline. Why on earth would they do that?
It does sound backwards, but they needed to push the steel into being hyper-eutectoid.
Hyper-mutectoid. That's a great word. What does it mean?
It just means the steel is super saturated with carbon. It has more carbon than the iron can actually dissolve at the target temperature. By bumping the carbon content from about 0.83% up to roughly 1.0%, the goal was to make sure that even when you heat it up, the solution is so full It can't dissolve everything.
So some of the seeds are forced to stay solid.
Exactly. They survive the heat.
Go back to the tea analogy. It's like putting so much sugar in the cup that no matter how much you stir, there's still that pile of sludge at the bottom.
That is the perfect analogy. Those undissolved sugar crystals are the cementite seeds. They are intentionally dirtying the mixture with these leftovers to build on later.
But there's another layer to this chemical war, isn't there? I read that superbainite relies heavily on silicon.
Yes, and this is a crucial point. Superbainite contains a lot of silicon, about 1.5%. Now, silicon is added specifically to prevent cementite from forming during the final cooling. That suppression is what makes superbainite tough.
So you have silicon fighting to stop cementite, and now you're adding carbon to encourage cementite.
Exactly. It's a tug of war. You have silicon saying, no seeds, and carbon saying, we need seeds. The thesis was trying to find the exact balance where carbon wins just enough to let us soften the material, but not so much that it ruins the final product.
That is a high-stakes balancing act. So how did they figure this out? They didn't just start mixing molten metal and hoping for the best, right?
No, of course not. They started with simulation. They used a thermodynamic modeling software called MTData.
I've heard of this. It's basically a crystal ball for metallurgy.
In a way, yeah. It calculates the phase diagrams based on the laws of thermodynamics. It tells you, if you have this much carbon, this much silicon, and you heat it to this temperature, here is exactly what structure will exist.
Which saves a lot of time and money.
A huge amount. So they ran the simulation looking for the Goldilocks zone. They needed a temperature that was hot enough to reset the bulk of the steel, but cool enough that those precious seeds wouldn't dissolve.
And what did the computer predict?
It suggested they needed to target about 3 to 4% by weight of undissolved cementite. Based on that, they designed two new test alloys, alloy A with 0.85% carbon and alloy B with 0.94% carbon.
And then came the real-world tests. They heated these alloys to different temperatures, 840, 870, 900, and 970 Celsius.
And the results were dramatic. Let's look at the high temperatures first. At 970 and 900 degrees, the experiment failed.
How'd it fail?
The temperature was just too high, the sugar melted, the seeds dissolved completely, and to make it worse, the grains of the steel, the little crystals that make it up, grew abnormally large.
And big grains are bad.
In steel, yes. Big grains usually mean poor toughness, so not only did they lose the seeds, they also ruined the microstructure. When they cooled these samples, DET didn't happen, they just got that hard layered perlite.
So 900 was too hot, that's oh. Right.
840 degrees Celsius, that proved to be the magic number. At 840, specifically with the higher carbon alloy B, the microscope images showed lots of undissolved cementite particles scattered through the structure.
The seeds survived the furnace.
They survived. And because they survived, when they cooled the steel down, the divorced eutectoid transformation took over immediately. The carbon latched onto the seeds, the soft ferrite formed around them, and they avoided the hard layers entirely.
That is the aha moment.
It really is.
By adding a bit more carbon winning that tug of war against the silicon and keeping the temp strictly at 840, they unlocked this faster softening pathway.
They effectively tricked the metal into cooperating.
But the proof is in the pudding.
Right.
For the hardness tester. Did it actually get soft enough? We talked about that 230 HV target.
It was a significant success. The thesis confirms that using this DET route, they got that ferrite plus spherical cementite structure, and the hardness test confirmed it dropped significantly, getting very close to that industrial standard.
And the time difference. We aren't talking 42 days anymore.
No. We're talking about a standard heating and cooling cycle, a matter of hours. It turns a month-long bottleneck into a daily process.
That changes everything for the economics of this material.
It makes it viable.
So, just to visualize this for everyone,
right?
Walk me through the full life cycle of a superbainite bearing made this way.
Okay. Step one. You cast your superbainite with this modified high-carbon recipe. It's just a raw block.
Right.
Step two, you heat it to 840 degrees, the Goldilocks temperature, and then cool it to trigger the DET.
Okay, now it's soft.
Step three, now you have a soft-ish piece of metal. You can put it on a lathe. You drill your holes, cut your grooves. You make the final bearing shape.
And then, because a soft bearing is a useless bearing.
Exactly. Step four is the final heat treatment. You heat it back up to dissolve everything again, resetting the structure one last time, and then you hold it at a low temperature, usually 200 Celsius.
And that turns it back into the monster.
That turns it back into the superhero. It transforms into that nanostructured bainite we started with. Hardness shoots back up to near 700 HDV, You end up with a high-performance part that you were actually able to manufacture.
It's amazing that the key to using this futuristic material was actually an old-school metallurgical trick, just tweaked with a bit more carbon.
It really highlights an important theme in material science. We get obsessed with the numbers. Highest strength, highest hardness. But it's not just about inventing the strongest material. It's about inventing a material you can actually build things with.
If you can't shape it, it just is a rock.
A very expensive, very impressive rock. But yes, the divorced eutectoid transformation is the bridge between a block of metal and a useful part.
Now, before we wrap up, I want to go back to that chemical war we mentioned, the silicon versus carbon thing.
Right.
The thesis proved this works for this specific alloy.
Right.
But it makes me wonder, are we close to a limit here?
That is the provocative thought. We're balancing on a knife edge. You've got manganese, chromium, molybdenum, silicon, carbon, all these elements interacting.
It's a complex cocktail.
It is. And remember, silicon is there to prevent cementite. Carbon is there to promote it. If engineers want to make the next version of Super Bainite even stronger, they might need to tweak the recipe. Maybe they add more silicon.
And if they do that?
The silicon might win the tug of war. The DET might stop working because the silicon suppresses the seeds too effectively. Or if they add too much carbon, the final product might become too brittle.
So this method, while brilliant, isn't a universal unlock key. It's a specific solution for a specific chemical balance.
Exactly. It's a reminder that metallurgy isn't just mixing ingredients in a pot. It's predicting how those ingredients fight each other at every single degree of temperature.
And that is why we need people like Daniel Luo running simulations instead of just swinging hammers.
Absolutely. The days of heat it and beat it are long gone. This is atomic level engineering.
So to wrap this up, we took a new age material, Super Bainite, that was chemically stubborn. We dirtied it with extra carbon, found the exact temperature, 840 degrees, to trick it into relaxing. And by doing that, we turned a scientific curiosity into something that could actually run inside the machines of tomorrow.
That is a perfect summary. We tamed the Super Bainite.
I love it. It makes you realize that sometimes the best way to move forward is to look back at the basics, like the divorced eutectoid transformation, and just apply them in a new way.
Context is everything.
That's it for this deep dive. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.